Take your Bibles and let's turn to Acts chapter 21. Acts chapter 21, and today we are working verse 27 through chapter 22 and verse 2. So Acts 21, 27 through 22 and verse 2. Acts 21, 27. When the 7 days were nearly over, some Jews from the province of Asia saw Paul at the temple. They stirred up the whole crowd and seized him, shouting, "Men of Israel, help us. This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against our people and our law and this place. And besides, he has brought Greeks into the temple area and defiled this holy place." They had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, in the city with Paul and assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple area. The whole city was aroused, and the people came running from all directions. Seizing Paul, they dragged him from the temple, and immediately the gates were shut. While they were trying to kill him, news reached the commander of the Roman troops that the whole city of Jerusalem was in an uproar. He at once took some officers and soldiers and ran down to the crowd. When the rioters saw the commander and his soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. The commander came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. Then he asked who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd shouted one thing and some another. And since the commander could not get at the truth because of the uproar, he ordered that Paul be taken into the barracks. When Paul reached the steps, the violence of the mob was so great he had to be carried by the soldiers. The crowd that followed kept shouting, "Away with him!" As the soldiers were about to take Paul into the barracks, he asked the commander, "May I say something to you?" "Do you speak Greek?" he replied. "Aren't you the Egyptian who started to revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the desert some time ago?" Paul answered, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no ordinary city. Please let me speak to the people." Having received the commander's permission, Paul stood on the steps and motioned to the crowd. When they were all silent, he said to them in Aramaic, "Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense." When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your presence with us today already in so many ways. And we ask that as we come before your word, that you would speak afresh to us, that we'd have ears to hear you, hearts to receive you, and may we be mindful to be obedient to you. Have your way amongst us for your glory. In Jesus' name we ask. Amen. Well, some of you have been here the past couple Sundays, some of you haven't. And so let me just kind of catch you up a little bit into this scene, because really from here all on out to the end of Acts, there's about 7 or 8 chapters to go to get to chapter 28. And it really is kind of one piece. It's one big story about Paul. And here we have Paul getting, quote unquote, arrested. And he's going to be under arrest the whole rest of the way. And so we really kind of slow down in one sense for these last 6, 7, 8 chapters. And it's kind of all about Paul and what he's going through as he has gone to Jerusalem and then under arrest, and then eventually he's going to make it to Rome. And you may or may not recall, but Paul had decided that he was going to go to Jerusalem. In fact, he wanted to finish up the third missionary journey and kind of wrap that up by going to Jerusalem and taking an offering from the churches that he had started and had ministered among, many Gentile converts in those churches, that he was going to take this offering from these mixed churches, a lot of Gentiles in them, and take that to the Jerusalem church, kind of the mother church, partly to meet the needs of the people there, but also to build unity between the churches, between kind of the mother church and his ministry among the Gentiles and in the Gentile world. He also felt very compelled by the Spirit to go. In fact, believer after believer had warned him, "Don't go to Jerusalem. It's not going to be pretty. You're going to face beating. You're going to be arrested." And one person even pulled off Paul's belt and told everybody that the owner of this belt is going to be bound and beaten and handed over to the Gentiles. Paul insisted on going, compelled by the Holy Spirit. And he wanted to go, and he wanted to get there in time for Pentecost, to celebrate Pentecost there. And he also wanted to go and kind of report to the elders of the church, the leaders of the Jerusalem church, what God had been doing through his ministry amongst the Gentiles. And so he goes. And last week we saw that he arrived in Jerusalem after all of the kind of the protests from fellow believers. He goes and they kind of pray, nonetheless, okay, Lord, your will be done. And he goes and he arrives and he is welcomed. He is greeted warmly by James, the leader of the church, and by the other leaders of the Jerusalem church. And Paul reports to them all that God had been doing through his ministry, and they celebrate and they praise God. And they report back to Paul what God had been doing there in Jerusalem and in Judea and that surrounding area, and how there had been thousands upon thousands of Jewish believers now, Jews who had confessed that Jesus is indeed their Messiah. But there were also rumors circulating in Jerusalem and thereabouts about Paul. And the rumors were that Paul was teaching Jews in other parts of the empire to turn against Moses, to turn against their customs, to turn against having their boys circumcised. And the Jewish believers in Jesus, they were still zealous for the law. They were still very proud of their heritage. They were still all about keeping their customs, circumcising their boys, dietary customs, all of that. And so it was very offensive to them to think that here was Paul teaching Jewish believers in other parts of the empire to kind of turn against their heritage, to turn against Moses and circumcision and all the customs. Well, these were rumors. And like most rumors, there's a little bit of truth, but there's a lot of untruth. So Paul wasn't really teaching people to turn against Moses or to turn against the law or even to turn against circumcision. He had Timothy circumcised. Paul's message had more to do with Jesus is the Messiah that we had longed for, that we had hoped for, that we had prayed for. And so Paul's preaching was not kind of anti-Jewish or anti-Moses. It was that Jesus is the fulfillment. And of course, that changed some things. That changed who you ate dinner with. That with Jesus as the fulfillment of the promises, now Jews and Gentiles who believed in Jesus, they could have fellowship together. And the Jews didn't need to worry about being defiled by having lunch with a Gentile believer. So he wasn't really preaching against Moses. He was preaching that Jesus is the fulfillment of what was hoped for and what was promised. And so there was some truth, but there was a whole lot of untruth in the rumors. Well, the church leaders, you know, were concerned about unity. And they were concerned about kind of demonstrating the falsehood of the rumors. And so they encouraged Paul, instructed Paul, that he should go through kind of this vow of purification. As he's come back from the Gentile world, that he should go through kind of a ritual bath, if you will, to kind of wash off the sins of the world symbolically as he is going to enter into the temple, this holy place. And so Paul agrees to that. And they also instruct him that it would be wise for him to pay for four other men to complete their purification vows so that the rest of the Jewish believers would see that Paul was not instructing Jewish men to go against Moses. He'd actually pay out of his own pocket for Jewish men to kind of live true to the purification customs. He agreed to that. And so this is going on. It takes about a week, and so the week is about complete. And now Paul and presumably these four men are back to the temple, and they're about to complete kind of this ritual of purification, probably kind of a ritual bath. And for the men, Paul was going to pay for some sacrifices, probably some doves to be sacrificed as part of their cleansing. Well, this is Pentecost, remember. And Pentecost was one of the major festivals. And so Jews from all over the empire would come to Jerusalem to celebrate the Feast of Pentecost. And Paul had spent about 3 years in Ephesus, and so he was fairly well known there. And there were some Jews from Ephesus, from Asia, most likely Ephesus, who were there, and they spotted Paul. they saw him in the temple, and they were outraged. These were not Jewish believers. These were just Jews who did not believe that Jesus was the Messiah. And I don't know how well you're remembering Acts, but you just might recall that when Paul was in Ephesus, there was a riot that broke out there as well. Paul did not always get along well with everybody. Maybe that's a way to say it. Not that it was his fault by any means. He was a believer. He took a stand. And those who did not confess that Jesus was Lord, they put him out of the synagogue. And they didn't like the results that they were seeing in terms of Gentiles being welcomed in to the people of God and the fellowship that developed between Jewish believers and Gentile believers. So Jewish unbelievers in Ephesus were very upset with Paul. And when they saw him in the temple, they were just outraged. And so they started to stir up the crowd. And they stirred up the crowd and started shouting that they needed help, that this guy Paul was teaching people everywhere to reject Moses, to reject Israel as a people, to reject the temple. Listen to their charges again. It's right there in 21, verse 28. They seize Paul. They're shouting, "Men of Israel, help us. This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against our people and against our law and against this place. And not only that, he has brought Greeks into the temple area and defiled this holy place." Now again, they're stirring up the crowd and they're making these charges against Paul, and they're kind of false charges. I mean, there might be a little bit of truth in the charges, but by and large, they are false charges. The charges are kind of in two categories. The first three things that they name off go together. So he's teaching everybody everywhere against our people and against our law and against this place, the temple. So basically he's promoting, he's teaching people to reject Judaism. Okay, that's charge number one, that Paul is there teaching people to reject Judaism, reject our people, reject our law, reject this temple. And then charge number two is that Paul has basically defiled the temple, that he has brought Greeks into the temple, and that was a capital punishment for someone who wasn't a Jew to enter into the temple. And so they're saying that he brought people in, and then not only did he bring people in, but then the consequence of that is that their presence defiled the temple. And so now the temple theoretically would need to be cleansed and rededicated to God. So huge charge. Now, again, kind of false charges, maybe a little bit of truth, but basically false. So in terms of charge number one, in terms of teaching against our people and against our law and against this place, Paul was teaching Jesus as a fulfillment. But they didn't like the message of fulfillment and the consequences of fulfillment. And so rather than embracing the message of fulfillment, they treated Paul as simply rejecting and teaching others against this place. And we kind of went down that path a little bit before, but realize that these are Jews who are saying this, not Jewish believers who are saying this. And so they are really turned against Paul, and there's no real satisfying them. And then I think it's just probably completely false that he brought Greeks into the temple. Because if you're Paul, you're not going to bring a Greek brother into the temple area, even if you think it's okay, because there are actually signs up saying that if you're not Hebrew and you enter into this, then your blood's on your own hands, that you're going to be killed because you've defiled the holy place. And so there's no way that Paul would bring a Greek friend into that kind of setting where basically he'd be put to death. All they know is that they saw Paul with another Ephesian brother. And they're thinking that, wow, Paul's with an Ephesian guy. I bet Paul did that. That's just the kind of guy Paul is. And so they spread the rumor, and notice what happens. The news spreads throughout the city that they got this guy who is defiling the temple. And everybody assembles at the temple, and they drag Paul out, and they shut the doors. And they're trying to kill Paul. It looks like some of those prophecies are coming true, that people told Paul that when you get to Jerusalem, everything's going to go to pieces, and you're going to find yourself bound and beaten, and here's Paul, and he's about ready to be killed. By the way, I don't know how well you remember, but remember when Stephen preached, or right before Stephen preached, what were the charges against Stephen? The charges against Stephen was that he was turning people away from the temple and turning people away from Moses. What are they saying about Paul? The very same thing. And by the way, who was there when Stephen got stoned? Paul was there. I'm sure Paul knew those charges well. He was standing there watching, giving approval, making sure that those who were throwing the stones and they had to take their cloaks off to get some power in their throws. So Paul was the cloak guarder. He knew the charges well, and now people are saying the same things about him that they said about Stephen. I think he knows that he's in a pretty precarious position, that he might not have much time left. And so they have begun to try to kill him, a riot kind of breaking out, and the temple gates have been shut. And the Roman commander charged with watching over the city, news comes to him about the violence that's taking place. And he and his troops rush in. This guy probably was in charge of over 1,000 maybe about 600-700 troops, maybe 300 cavalry stationed right there close to Jerusalem, close to the temple, and they hear it. They rush right in on the situation, and of all things, the Romans rescue Paul. They weren't trying to rescue him. They just didn't want a riot in Jerusalem. The Romans like order, and they saw the disorder, and so notice who they arrest. They arrest the guy that's getting beaten up. They don't arrest the people that are, you know, throwing the stones or throwing the fist. They arrest the guy that's getting beaten up, and they carry him off. They interrogate him. What did you do that everybody's trying to kill you? And we kind of get that whole thing. It's kind of a cliffhanger where I shut off today. The Roman commander actually thinks, when he hears Paul speak Greek, he actually thinks that he might be a former rebel that is trying to create another plot and against Rome, and maybe the people are kind of taking matters into their own hands. Some of your translations say that this Egyptian Jewish rebel led a group known as the Assassins. Sometimes it's referred to as kind of the daggers, and what they would do is they were kind of pro-Jewish, anti-Roman. And so what they would do is they would try to terrorize and eliminate Jewish people who were pro-Roman and create kind of a fear so that you would motivate people to rebel against Rome. And the reason why they were known as kind of the Assassins or the Daggers is because they would do their work in a crowd. And so in a crowded assembly of people, maybe at the temple or maybe in the city courts or wherever, and if they knew that you were kind of pro-Rome, they would find a way to get next to you with their dagger, and they would stab you and kill you and then slip off through the crowd. And so they thought maybe Paul was the leader of that bunch, and he was trying to stage some type of a rebellion against Rome. He assures them that he's not, and then he asks if he could speak to the crowd. And of all things, the Roman commander says, okay. He sees that Paul is not a threat to Rome. Nowhere is Christianity ever really seen at this point as a threat to Rome. And so he gives Paul permission to speak to the crowd after saving Paul from the crowd. And Paul speaks in Aramaic to the crowd, kind of the Hebrew dialect, the common tongue of Jews. And they grow silent. And he addresses them as my father and my brothers. And you'll have to come back next week to see what he said. But here's what I want us to focus on today. So he's in Jerusalem, and he's been beat, and he's been arrested. And in some respects, everything that had been said, every warning, had come true. He's now under the charge of Gentiles, just like Agabus had said. But it's not exactly like Agabus said. The expectation was when you get handed over to the Romans, you're going to be executed right then and there, just like Jesus was. And what we find out is, unknowing to the Romans at this point, that they're actually the instrument that God's using to save Paul so that he can testify again. I mean, of all things, that you're going to go to Jerusalem and your own people are going to try to kill you, and they're going to hand you over to the Romans, and to everybody's surprise, the Romans are actually going to give you protection, and the Romans are going to give you opportunity to testify. God has a way of sometimes fulfilling prophecy, fulfilling promises in ways that go a little bit beyond what we would have imagined or expected. And we see that going on here. And maybe just a side note on that. Maybe you feel like you have some promises from God. Maybe some things have been spoken over you. And that's all good. But just realize that God has a way of kind of doing some things that may be a little bit even beyond, unexpected beyond, what has been promised you or what you feel has been spoken over you. And so we see that here with Paul, that God is doing more than what anybody actually imagined. That the Romans are providing the platform to testify and to preach. The other thing or two that I want us to think about here is that God has a way of advancing the gospel no matter how great the obstacle. Let me say that again. God has a way of seeing to it that the gospel is advanced no matter what the obstacle. And so what we have going on here is Paul is about ready to be put to death. A riot is swirling around him. People are beating him. People are ready to kill him right then and there. And again, the Romans come storming in. And yes, they arrest him, but they get him out of there. And the violence is so great against Paul that the Roman soldiers actually have to pick Paul up and carry him into the barracks. And yet what happens? He preaches, and the gospel is advanced. And when we follow this out, we're going to see that Paul gets more than one occasion to preach and to share his testimony. And the audiences change, and he's before high, and he's before low, and the gospel advances. An incredible obstacle, but the gospel advances. I think about Paul's line in Philippians. It's in chapter 1. He's under arrest. And he tells the church, I want you to know that what has happened to me, who would have thought it? What has happened to me has actually turned out for the advancement of the gospel. So I don't know what you're going through. But I do want you to realize that God has a way of seeing to it that no matter what the obstacles are, the gospel advances. And whatever is happening to you, just realize that somehow, some way, God is going to create an opportunity to testify, an opportunity to witness, that somehow, some way, no matter what you're going through, God is going to open something up for the advancement of the gospel. That we see that time and time again throughout Acts, and now we're seeing it right here in Paul's life, where it looks like everything is closing down and it looks like it's the end. It actually gets opened back up, and the gospel advances. And I know you might be thinking about Stephen, and you might be thinking about James, two of the early martyrs, but even when everything was closing in on them, Stephen, kind of one last sermon. You could argue about whether or not he got to finish it, but the gospel advanced. And James, he didn't die in vain. The gospel advanced. And we see this kind of time and time again, that no matter how it looks like the world would try to shut down, yet the gospel advances. I don't know exactly what to do with they closed the temple gates. On the one hand, they closed the temple gates because they didn't want this defilement to kind of take place in the temple, this violence, this murder, this death. Well, they wouldn't have seen it as murder. They would have seen it as an execution. But they wouldn't want that in the temple. So the gates are shut. Keep the violence, keep the mob outside. But at the same time, who have they really shut the gates on? Well, they shut the gates on Paul. And they shut the gates on Paul's witness, Paul's testimony. And in some sense, they're shutting the gates on the church. And so these gates close. The very place where the gospel should be proclaimed from, where it was proclaimed from at that first Pentecost, there in the kind of the temple courts, these gates close. And as soon as those gates close, a new gate's opened up. And the Roman, the commander, he's one step above a centurion. The Roman commander is actually providing a place, a space for Paul to proclaim the gospel. A couple other things just want to think about. This trial. So Paul is going to be put on trial. He's going to get a trial before the Sanhedrin coming up here in chapter 23. He's kind of on trial here before the Roman centurion and the crowd. His trial is going to expand over the next several chapters. Eventually, his trial is going to go all the way to Rome. We don't ever completely read how his trial turned out, but one of the things that happens in this trial is that Paul has opportunity to redefine the charges that are against him. So you notice the charges that came from the Ephesian Jews were that Paul was speaking against the Jews, speaking against the law of Moses, speaking against the temple, and that he was defiling the temple. Those are kind of the charges. But when it actually comes to court, Paul is given opportunity to say what he's on trial for. He gets to frame the charge. And as Paul frames the charge, what he insists is that he is actually on charge or on trial for the hope of the resurrection. That he is actually on trial for the hope of Israel. And so Paul gets to kind of reframe it to where he's being charged for being faithful to the tradition, for being faithful to the heritage, for being faithful to the promises. Now, I won't unpack all that's coming, but here's what I think we need to see that's going to happen time and time again. That Paul's on trial, but who's really on trial? See, the Jews who are prosecuting, they're the ones who actually are on trial. And the jury is, first and foremost, Theophilus. That's who Luke's writing for. See, as Luke tells the story and tells what's happened, the person that he's actually writing for is Theophilus. And Theophilus is the one who's got to make a decision. Theophilus is the one, we don't know a whole lot about him. We think he was a God-fearing Gentile who became a believer in Jesus. We think he was probably connected with the synagogue, connected with some Jewish leadership. And we think that he became a believer under the preaching of people like Paul, maybe not Paul himself, possibly, but became a believer under this preaching. And now he's probably being told, don't listen to that foolishness. that is against our people and that's against our God, and that you're wasting your time going that way. And so all of this is being told to Theophilus, and it's like Theophilus is the jury, and he has to come to a verdict on Paul. Is Paul really betraying the heritage and the promises that came through Abraham and Moses and David and all of Israel? Is Jesus the Messiah? Should he listen to what Paul has been preaching, or should he reject Paul and his message? And as Luke lays it all out so masterfully, what we see is Paul is the righteous one. Paul is the one who, well, I just ask you, in this scene, who looks like they're behaving righteously? Looks like Paul is doing it right. Who looks like they're defiling the temple? This Jewish leadership that has stirred up a mob and doesn't care about the Romans, and they're ready to just be done with Paul. They can get it done in the temple or get it done outside the temple, but they'll stir the whole city up. Who looks like they're living more faithful to the heritage and the customs and the promises? And so we'll see this type of thing happen scene after scene, where when you really kind of stop and look at it, who's the one that you want to follow? Who do you want to be a part of? And so the story kind of unfolds and unfolds, and you'll just have to keep coming back. But realize kind of how it's working, and that Theophilus is the jury, and Theophilus has to make a decision about who he's going to listen to. And in many respects, that's how it speaks to us as well, that we're the jury. And we're having to decide if we will keep believing Paul's gospel, even when it might get costly. And kind of the question that maybe Theophilus is asking, maybe the question that we have to wrestle with in some kind of way, is God really with Paul? And should I really believe what Paul is saying about Jesus? That Jesus is the Messiah, that he's been resurrected from the dead, and that when we turn to him, there's forgiveness, there's transformation, there's the hope of resurrection for ourselves. Do we believe that or not? And no doubt, for Theophilus, it probably would have meant some suffering. It would have meant some rejection. That he had good Jewish friends who weren't believers, and they might just cut him off, and in all likelihood they would cut him off and reject him as a friend. And they might gossip about him just like they gossiped about Paul or others. Is he willing to bear that cost? Does he really believe that Paul's right about Jesus? And if Paul's right about Jesus, then he needs to endure that cost. But I also think he'll discover that as he endures that cost, the Lord keeps opening up doors to witness, that the gospel will not be stopped, will not be hindered. I don't know. I kind of wonder how often we find ourselves maybe in those places. We don't really think about it quite so much like that. Like, I don't know, we normally don't approach it like, do I believe Paul or not? We normally just think, do I believe in Jesus or not? But Theophilus had heard about Jesus through Paul or somebody like that. And so it really became an issue. Who am I going to listen to? The preacher or the Jews who reject Jesus? And he finally decides, I imagine, that he's going to listen to the preacher, no matter what the cost. And we see that every time things close in on the preacher, Paul or Luke or whomever, opens up opportunity. I don't know why, but in working with this, a memory came back from way back in like 8th or 9th grade. I went to Hale Junior High, which is where Horizon Christian Campus is now. It was a city school then. And been here for a couple of years. My family moved out here when I was in 7th grade. And we went to San Diego First Church, which in those days it wasn't out on the point. It was actually where New Creation is at now, if you know New Creation. And had a couple friends. I'd been playing basketball. And so Kenny Peters, he was probably maybe the best athlete in the school, played quarterback, point guard, could shoot. Kenny Peters. And been part of youth group and thinking, yeah, I should invite one of my friends to church. Wow, it would be so great to get Kenny Peters to come to church. Because, you know, Kenny Peters was kind of the center of the junior high world, at least from what I could see. And so I tried to invite him, got nowhere. And kind of this sense of rejection and, like, maybe church wasn't cool enough for Kenny Peters. Maybe church just isn't cool. And so I was kind of disappointed, and yet right there in the locker room was Mike McKinnon. And Mike McKinnon barely made any team. I mean, he made a team, but barely made a team. Red-haired kid, a little bit on the chubby side. Certainly not Kenny Peters. But Mike McKinnon was there. And it was like this opportunity opened up from rejection to opportunity. And I invited Mike McKinnon to come because I wasn't going to be defeated, even though I felt a little bit defeated. I wasn't going to be defeated. So Kenny Peters wouldn't come, but Mike McKinnon was there. One rejection led to another opportunity. I invited Mike McKinnon to come. And Mike McKinnon came with me off and on throughout junior high and high school to our Wednesday night youth group. And he came from a Catholic background. But he would come on Wednesday nights and be part of kind of our fellowship, do some stuff with us. And it was one of my best friends going through high school, and never did have that close of a relationship with Kenny Peters. I don't know why that came this morning, but maybe it's just that type of a thing to where there's going to be rejection. There's going to be people who don't listen to you. There's going to be people who turn on us. There's going to be people who try to shut it down. And you might get, you know, kind of beat like Paul, but it might be more just we don't want to hear it. But every time some place closes down, every time a venue shuts down, you can be assured that there's going to be something else open up. Another person to speak to, another occasion that maybe would have never happened were it not for the one being shut down. But there will be obstacles, and there will be rejection, and there will be prices to pay. But you can be certain that the gospel is going to go forth. And God's going to keep granting you opportunity after opportunity to testify, to share his love, to share his grace, to share the good news that Jesus is Lord. And so don't be discouraged and don't give up. If Kenny Peters slams the door in your face, just know that Mike McKinnon's right there. And you'll have opportunity. And why don't we take communion together? And I invite you to stand. And Charlene, would you and Danny come back and do the special? I kind of feel like that's very fitting in terms of the message. Paul didn't know how it was all going to work out, didn't know how it was all going to, wasn't going to understand it all. But just every time something happened that seemed like it would be an ending, it turned into a beginning, a new place to proclaim. The gospel would keep advancing. So I invite you to come, and I invite you to receive the cup and receive the bread and return to your seats, and we'll take communion together, trusting that through this sacrament, the Lord will continue to build us together and continue to form his gospel within us and form us in the gospel so that we're not discouraged or overwhelmed when things close down. We have the faith and the knowledge that there's just a new venue opening up. The gospel will go forth. Would you come?
Tempted and tried, we're oft made to wonder why it should be thus all the day long, while there are others living about. Coming in glory. is worthy of my call. I want to live a life, Lord, is worthy of my call. And I believe you can change me. I believe you can use this life, and I believe you can make me an instrument for no
take my life.